Welcome to Tau Center for the Arts Radio Hour. I'm Chelsea. Today we hear from Cassandra Keys, an archaeologist. Keys' interest in beautiful and intriguing discoveries started as a child, looking for rocks for her grandmother's garden. Her passion for keen observation and human cultures grew with her, with a dabble in ancient Egypt mysteries when she was 10 and a love for solitary hikes across plains and mountains as she got older. Today, Keys works in northern New Mexico, contracting for local agencies. She tells us about her interest in the unique discipline of archaeology. Here is her conversation with Alice Moyon.
My very first question was related to the meaning of that word, archaeology, because it is the study of human history and prehistory through the excavation of sites and the analysis of artifacts and other physical remains. And can you tell us a little bit what the difference is between history and prehistory? Like, is it just a different period of time, or is there a more significant difference between those two words?
That's a really good question. As you mentioned, archaeology is the study of past human cultures through analysis or investigation of the objects that they left behind. And so for convenience, I think, archaeologists have kind of decided to arbitrarily divide that past into prehistoric and historic time periods. And so the historic period generally refers to the time after the invention or the development of writing. Mm-hmm. And then prehistory is everything that happened before that time or before writing. And this is obviously different in different places in the world because writing happened, earlier in some places than it did in others. But here in the Western Hemisphere, we generally refer to the historic period as the time, after the arrival of the Europeans, 15th century-ish. And then prehistory is everything that happened before that time.
That's crazy. That means that in Europe and in the U.S., prehistory is not doesn't mean the same thing.
And writing, it could be wrong, developed in China and so long ago. But prehistory, too, I think is important. It's a relatively recent term that was actually kind of first used in Europe, in the mid-19th century. There's actually a lot of debate now among archaeologists on whether using the term prehistoric to refer to these past cultures like an appropriate term, and that's because I think for example it kind of assumes that the cultures that were in existence before the arrival of the Europeans that didn't have writing were somehow less sophisticated or they were less advanced than people who had writing, and it also then kind of in that way ignores the use of symbols and markings and other drawings that could have been used as systems of writing, it also kind of ignores the fact that cultures that were here before the Europeans had these really elaborate oral traditions and stories that they had used to tell each other their histories and their past. When you look at rock art, it is ubiquitous up and down the Rio Grande, and and we don't really know what those kind of messages convey if it was their system of writing.
As an archaeologist, you cannot study everything that was in the past. You must have picked a specific period of time to study. Is yours in the prehistory or is it in the history?
Yeah, it would be definitely the prehistoric. The time period that I kind of know the most about is referred to as the early archaic, but it's about 8,000 years ago.
One of the first questions I had for you is why archaeology? Why did you decide to go for this?
I think about this question all the time and why I've chosen this path. But for me, it just kind of always has had a fascination, with the past and all old things, things that are old, I guess. But what I enjoy most about archaeology is, when you're walking around and you find an object that someone made thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
And then in some cases hasn't been touched, in all of that time. And so it's really exciting and special to find something like that. And for me, I just kind of want to know everything about it. And so if you think, each one of these objects that you find has its own story to tell. And so what interests me most is trying to figure out what that story is, who made this thing? How was it made? Why is it here? What significance, if any, might it have? I don't know. I guess I've always also liked doing puzzles.
Okay.
And so for me, archaeology is just kind of doing a big puzzle.
Yeah.
And trying to fit all of those pieces together, finding the objects and putting them all into the big picture.
Yeah. I love
and
that.
So it's not math, where there's these hard and fast rules also. So as part of that puzzle, it's archaeology is like a super interpretive science.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
it doesn't have those rules. So
yeah.
you can kind of get to like make up stories.
I love that.
You know, about the objects that you find.
Try to figure out what happened to it. And yeah, mm-hmm. I like the idea of the story behind those objects.
Well, and the fun thing about that story too, which also is, you know, I like about archaeology, and it's like any science where things are constantly evolving as
mm-hmm.
like new evidence comes to light, or you have different methods for kind of studying something. So often that story can change
mm-hmm.
depending on, you know, the research questions that you're asking or how you go about analyzing or looking at artifacts.
What about New Mexico? I'm curious, what is the state of knowledge about who was in New Mexico in the first place and how long ago were the first humans here?
So if we think about like North America in general,
mm-hmm.
we do know, you know, the evidence suggests, you know, we look at evidence like linguistics and genetics and then the archaeology, of course, and all of those things combined kind of suggest that people have been in North America for at least 14,000 years. If not longer, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, we do know for sure that they were here at that time. And then as far as New Mexico goes, have you heard about the footprint site down
yes.
in the White Sands?
Just recently, like a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, that's when it kind of came out, was a few weeks ago. And so basically these researchers are claiming that they have evidence for people playing around like a lakeshore about 23,000 years ago. And they don't have any artifacts.
Uh-huh.
They're looking at, but they do have our footprints that have been preserved in the sand.
How can that be? How can footprints still be around?
The environment, I'm not super familiar with it, but the environment down in White Sands is actually pretty, it's very unique
uh-huh.
in the type of sand that it is.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, things like your footprint goes in the sand and it dries out really quickly and then subsequently gets buried also really quickly.
Uh-huh.
It can kind of preserve that shape. And so they're excavating. You know, the environment down there is really dynamic, so things
uh-huh.
are constantly changing, so if the wind moves or
whatever
they can see.
And how do they know how old that is?
So what they did was they dated seeds, that like from plants that would have been growing around the lakeshore, and they dated them, the layers of seeds that were above and below the footprints, and they came up with that time frame. And I don't know, I'm not entirely convinced, but I encourage everyone to, you know, go and Google it and look at it.
What do you mean you're not entirely convinced? You're like, maybe these are more recent than what they think?
They could have been. I mean, I'm definitely a smoking gun evidence kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
Like I need, you know, that hard evidence. And they're dating, I think, you know, the seeds can kind of like float up and down in water in the surface.
I see.
So that could have done something.
Mm-hmm.
Been involved.
Right.
So I would kind of like to see some more, you know, concrete
things
that are around.
You're mentioning artifacts, and so I'm really curious. Can you tell us a little bit what an artifact is?
An artifact is typically anything that has been made or modified by a human and can be moved around, so like you can kind of pick it up. Things that, so if you think about like an archaeological site or things that are typically big or in the ground, like a house or
mm-hmm.
like a hearth or, you know, kind of structures. Those
mm-hmm.
are typically referred to as features. And you can kind of think of them as something that, like, cannot be readily removed
I see.
From the site or from an area.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. But I want to go back to your question about how long people have been here.
Yeah, oh yeah, because we never did get the answer. I'm sorry.
We do know that, you know, in New Mexico that people have been here during the Clovis times, which is a time period that roughly dates to around 12,000 years ago. So we definitely have, you know, some hard evidence for that. And Clovis is generally is accepted as being like the first cultural tradition in North America. The first people, there are some, you know, pre-Clovis researchers out there, but again, there's not this like unequivocal evidence.
Mm-hmm.
You have clear association with artifacts with a certain time period. And so when those artifacts are kind of found in association with something that can be dated, like bones or charcoal,
mm-hmm.
then we can get some idea of the time frame for when people, you know, occupied a site. And so Clovis is most commonly associated with, like, the big mammoth kill sites.
Okay.
And we know that those kinds of animals were here at the end of the Ice Age.
Mm-hmm.
And so to find, we also know then, by looking at the artifacts in association with the remains of some of those animals, that humans were here then also during that time.
Were these animals and humans, were they here in New Mexico or is it in different parts of North America?
Clovis was all over North America, for sure. Yeah, I think there's even some sites like in northern Mexico.
Cool.
Not so much in Canada because of ice sheets and things, but you do see them all over North America from East Coast to West Coast.
Crazy. And do we know where these humans came from? Did they come from Asia?
Yeah, that's the general consensus
okay.
in terms of, you know, looking at, again, the linguistics and the genetic evidence.
Especially. I see. Yeah.
And again, you know, this information, as we get more evidence and the way that we look at things and the questions that we ask changes. So now, I know there's different theories of people coming over the ice bridge, mm-hmm. you know, from Beringia down the coast, uh-huh. through the ice-free corridor, and then during, I guess, yeah, the last ice age, 14,000 years ago, people moving in. And there's, you know, in New Mexico specifically, there are some really cool sites, like the Folsom site, which kind of postdates Clovis immediately, is like the cultural tradition that happened after Clovis. And then, so their points are a little bit different style.
I see.
You know, they're different. But there's, you know, really important site, the Folsom site in eastern New Mexico.
Okay.
That was discovered in like the 1920s by an African-American cowboy who had recognized some bones coming out of the arroyo. And he recognized those bones as being really old. And so he brought it to the attention of some paleontologists in Colorado, and they came down and looked at it. And as they were, you know, excavating these bones out, actually what they ended up finding was one of these Folsom points embedded in the ribs of one of the animals. But that site is really significant, actually, because before that time, before they discovered that, there was a lot of debate among scientists about, like, the origins of Native Americans and for how long people had been in North America prior to the arrival of Europeans.
Okay.
And so what this site did in particular was provide some, like, unequivocal evidence that humans were here at the end of the last ice age. And it is important because it kind of changed the way we think about archaeology, and it settled this, like, really long debate about people had been here.
What would have been the other option, that people had been here like so much, like for a much shorter amount of time?
One of the early assumptions was that the Native Americans, when the Europeans arrived, were from, you know, the lost tribes of Israel. Even like, you know, strange things like that. And for a lot of Europeans, you know, there was a lot of sophisticated things happening
mm-hmm.
in North America at that time. Like you have the mounds that are in kind of like the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
They're huge earthen structures.
Okay.
And they have like really cool artifacts and burials and things. And, you know, you have like Chaco Canyon here uh-huh. in the Southwest. And so I don't think that Europeans wanted to believe that Native Americans could have constructed something like that.
That's crazy.
It goes into that whole
I see. Yeah.
Nasty history with.
Yeah. And so discovering that site was proof that people had been in North America since the last
long time.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like, yeah.
I mean,
so they were like, all right, people have been here, we cannot just pretend something else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
okay.
Folsom sites date to about 11,000 years ago.
And when was that discovered?
In the 1920s.
1920s, right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So not that long ago.
No. So I think, right? I think if you go to like the Denver Museum of Nature and Science,
mm-hmm.
I think it's called now. They have the projectile point embedded in the ribs, like on display.
This was Cassandra Keys, an archaeologist in northern New Mexico, sharing her knowledge on the people that inhabited North America thousands of years ago. More from Keys when we come back, as she takes us into the unique work of archaeologists who, not unlike detectives, observe clues, draw interpretations, and try to get a bit closer to understanding the past. Welcome back to TCA Radio Hour. I'm Chelsea. Today, Alice Morion talks with Cassandra Keys. Keys got a master's degree in public archaeology from the University of New Mexico, which she applies today to her work in northern New Mexico. She tells us about the archaeological process and how all the elements preserved from the past help us understand the cultures of the people that were here before. Here is Keys telling us about an artifact commonly found in northern New Mexico and beyond, projectile points.
In archaeology, we say projectile points, because you don't want to assume that you knew how that weapon
there.
Was
yeah.
attached to something. So, like, in, you know, the bow and arrow wasn't invented until way later. Like a dart point, spear point, arrow point. I like to just say point.
Yeah.
But the technical term is projectile point.
Okay, good to know. And so when you're on the site, that's what you're looking for, is those points to get a sense of who was there based
yeah.
on the design and, I don't know, the shape and how it's made.
Yeah, and for prehistoric stuff, you find, well, that's where it gets tricky. For stone tools, yeah. Like if you're finding a site that was what we call a lithic scatter, which is all of the chippings
uh-huh.
that you see on the ground, the flakes. If you find one of the points, you can those that there's certain styles that are associated with certain time periods.
I see.
And so you can kind of roughly date it.
Cool. And so is that all that you use when you find something? You're just looking at the artifact itself and what it looks like? Or does the location and like the arrangement of the whole situation also inform very much what you're looking at?
Yeah, so the archaeologist can look at those particular artifacts to determine how old a site is and to help us understand the culture
mm-hmm.
That's associated with it. But there are definitely certain characteristics that convey information. So if we think of terms of the prehistoric artifacts, we can look at the shape of the projectile points.
Mm-hmm.
So for the Folsom Point, for example, is a very distinct style of point that was only around 11,000 years ago. And for a short amount of time, even too, it was a short-lived culture. It was only a few hundred years that you see that style of point being made. There's also ceramics, like the types of materials that were used to make pottery and the types of depictions that are on them, the types
mm-hmm.
of designs,
mm-hmm.
those kinds of things are all diagnostic. Historic artifacts, you know, you can have like cans or
uh-huh.
bottles
uh-huh.
were manufactured using certain materials during certain times. And or even the way that they were opened,
mm-hmm.
you know, like purple glass
mm-hmm.
is, we can date sites if we find purple glass,
that
or if
sense.
You find cans that have been, like, you know, opened with an ice pick instead of a church key or a pull tab,
mm-hmm.
then that kind of gives you some idea also of how things are dated.
How cool.
But, you know, a single artifact, so artifacts, a single artifact can tell you very little
mm-hmm.
about a culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we do is we look at that whole scene, which we refer to as context.
Mm-hmm.
And so context is basically where an artifact is found and what it's found with or in relation to provides the context for that.
Right.
And so I guess just to give you an example, if we think about having like a beautiful painted like ceramic bowl,
mm-hmm.
that object is going to have a very different meaning if it's found like in a burial context.
Yeah.
Then it's going to have, if it's found, you know, full of corn in a rock shelter or in a storage pit, the significance of that object is going to change further if it's found, you know, if you have it, like, on your coffee table. When you think about that example, that's how we can kind of understand, you know, the artifacts are not significant because of what they are,
mm-hmm.
but because of where they're found.
And I'm assuming that's why you're not supposed to pick up arrowheads or, you know, whatever you may found here in New Mexico, and like, oh, that's so cool, I'm going to bring it home and put it on my shelf. But that's probably part of the reason is that you actually need the context to understand what that is and what it means.
Yeah. I'm so glad that you asked this question, actually, because it's something that's really important. I just want to say, like, I totally understand people's desire to,
mm-hmm.
you know, pick things up. Like, I grew up rock hounding, and I love to take my boys fossil hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's super exciting to find something that's, like, special and unique. And whether it's a fossil or, you know, a piece of driftwood or
mm-hmm.
an unusual rock,
mm-hmm.
the
mm-hmm.
bottle, like whatever, you want to, like, take it home and show it to all your friends and be like, look at this cool thing I found. But when it comes to artifacts and cultural items, there's a few reasons, I think, why you should leave them there. I'd say, most importantly, a lot of these items, it's important to recognize that they have cultural value still. So a lot of these artifacts, you know, represent the material remains of the ancestors of the tribes who are still living here. And so for them, you know, those artifacts may still be imbued with meaning,
mm-hmm.
and they may still be a real connection between those objects
right.
and
mm-hmm.
the people who still live here. And so, when you know, also when you remove those artifacts, you're kind of removing the only physical traces that we have of the histories of the people who have been here
mm-hmm.
you know, for thousands of years.
Yeah.
And so I definitely think that's one of the most important reasons to leave things there. But another reason to leave artifacts in place is so that they can be protected from mm-hmm. development or vandalism. And so one of the ways that archaeologists are able to kind of date sites, again, is by looking at the artifacts that are there. When we tell how old a site is, we can evaluate it.
Yeah.
And also,
another there are reason. Many
reasons. But they, you know, artifacts should be left where they are because of the research potential of some of these sites and what they might be able to convey for future research. And so, you know, as soon as those objects are removed from their location, they lose their research potential.
Mm-hmm.
So if we don't know how old the site is or to which culture it belongs, mm-hmm. then it's kind of hard to evaluate that site and understand how maybe like that site in particular would be able to help us like answer questions
right.
about the past
mm-hmm.
and the people who lived here. The artifacts help archaeologists tell the story of the past.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when those items are removed, we no longer can make sense of that story. And so it's similar to, like, if you were to take random chapters out of a book,
mm-hmm.
you know, that book might not make any sense, but then also, like, the chapters in and of themselves wouldn't really make much sense. So you really need the whole book. But ultimately, to answer your question, can you pick it up? You can pick it up and look at it. You can feel it. You can appreciate it. You can make your own connection with the past. Take a picture of it, take a GPS point if you've got a GPS, and then you can always, you know, inform an archaeologist about what you found. But yeah, please don't take anything from a site and take it home with you. Lastly, there are laws. And because of that cultural and research potential, there are several laws that have been enacted to protect those cultural resources.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, whatever your intentions are of picking those artifacts up, it doesn't have to, you don't have to be out at a site like with a shovel,
mm-hmm.
you know, digging for things. You could just simply be picking up an arrowhead
mm-hmm.
from public land specifically. But there are those laws that, you know, can get you in trouble. I guess it's a punishable offense to pick up artifacts.
Yeah.
And so picking them up constitutes looting.
I see. Yeah. And what's the difference between like, you mentioned public land. What if it's on private property? If it's in your backyard, are you just free to do whatever you want with it? Or do you still have some sort of obligation, whether it's just moral or just lawful?
That's a tough question. that is really actually a tough question to answer. And I don't think that it's one that can be easily answered. You know, archaeology raises this like really hairy issue of who owns the past.
Mm-hmm.
But the short and easy answer is that I think artifacts, in a sense, you know, belong to all of us because we all have something to benefit from the knowledge that's gained by studying these artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
But technically speaking, if you find artifacts on private land, those objects belong to the landowner.
I see.
So unless, you know, you have a burial or you find human remains or something, then there's a set of laws that can kind of come into play.
Uh-huh.
But on federal land, cultural resources technically belong to the public,
mm-hmm.
And then they are managed by the Land Management Agency,
the
Forest Service, or the BLM, or the state, or whatever, and they're managed, you know, for the benefit of everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but just because it belongs to the public, if you could think about it that way, then it doesn't mean that if you find something,
it belongs to you.
That it belongs to you, right?
Yeah.
So my personal feeling is that I don't, that we know we shouldn't think of these objects really as belonging to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
I think that instead we should consider ourselves stewards
mm-hmm.
of these objects and stewards as rather than, you know, owners of the past.
Yeah.
And so I think it's just in everybody's interest. But these are a non-renewable resource, right? Like when you take it, it's gone.
Yeah.
And so I think it's in everybody's interest to ensure that these resources are valued and protected
mm-hmm.
So that they can be enjoyed by everyone,
you know,
like us now, and then also especially future generations.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. And I want to go back to something you mentioned just earlier about the cultural relevance of these objects, tribes or pueblos or native nations around here that are somewhat related to these objects, like maybe it's ancestors of current humans around, and like what's the relationship between people and what is found, and can you ask for advice?
So archaeology kind of has this complicated
mm-hmm.
and shameful history in terms of how things were done in the past, and you know, archaeologists haven't always had a good relationship with indigenous groups. So for a long time there hasn't been a great deal of information exchange going on.
Mm-hmm.
I think but more and more archaeologists are realizing, you know, the importance of tribal consultation and incorporating Native perspectives into their research or into decision-making.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the kinds of questions that you're asking of the tribes kind of has a lot to do with the tribe that you're consulting with. And so I can't speak for the tribes, but I know for a lot of them that the information that they have is secret. And so these artifacts, that even just by you, like, having them,
mm-hmm.
you know, they've lost their significance. And they may not be willing to just share information about that object for various reasons. But I think it's always important to listen.
Yeah.
To, you know, be open to some of these alternate perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Is there any sense of ownership? Is there any time where it's like, actually, like, this should be given back to us because this belongs to our culture? Is that a conversation that's going on?
That is definitely a conversation that is going on. And in the 1990s, you know, there was a law that was passed on the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which we refer to as NAGPRA. And that has a lot to do with returning artifacts to groups. And then also now, you know, if you find remains, especially funerary items or buried
mm-hmm.
remains,
mm-hmm.
you have to consult with the tribes. And you let all of them know, and then they, you know, make a claim to the things that you're finding. And
I see. Okay. Wow.
But yeah, that is a huge thing in archaeology. And it's a big deal for a lot of the museums now, too, where, again, I mentioned that kind of controversial past archaeology has, where
mm-hmm.
you know, looting a lot of these sites was a big deal, and people just kind of took things willy-nilly and sent them off to museums and, you know, without any respect for the cultures that were there or to whom they might belong.
Yeah.
And so museums, too, now are in a process of going through a lot of those items and consulting with the tribes and repatriating.
All right, back to your work as an archaeologist. Like, once you have been to the site, you have identified the artifacts, you have an idea of when, you know, people were there. What do you do with this information? What's the point?
So ultimately, you know, the goal of archaeology is to understand why and how human behavior has changed over time.
Uh-huh.
And it's through an investigation of the artifacts, you know, and features that we do this. And so in terms of what I do, which is cultural resource management, all of this information gets summarized
mm-hmm.
into something that sounds like this. I'm just going to read you a little.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
I just totally made it up. But Site 07 is a high-density artifact scatter of Jicarilla Apache affiliation. The site consists of several hundred artifacts in a 50 by 50 meter area, and the site is situated on a gentle south-facing slope in an overall broad sagebrush plain. So vegetation at the site consists predominantly of sagebrush, along with a few small pinyon and juniper trees, rabbit brush, and other various grasses and forbs. And the Sangre de Cristo Mountains are visible to the east. Diagnostic artifacts include a metal projectile point, an amethyst glass bead, and micaceous ceramics. No features were identified. However, the sediment at the site is at least 40 centimeters deep. So the number and diversity of artifacts at the site, coupled with the amount of natural sediment, suggests the possibility of subsurface features. And so we take that information,
mm-hmm.
and so you can kind of see from that description how we collect lots of things from the overall scene. Like,
mm-hmm.
all the artifacts are important. The location of the site is important, like, not just in terms of where it physically actually is on the landscape, but, like, the kinds of things that you see in the whole setting,
mm-hmm.
like,
mm-hmm.
what's visible in the landscape.
Yeah.
And that,
yeah.
And so obviously it can get more detailed. And then we go through a whole process of evaluating the sites to determine their significance,
uh-huh.
the whole scene.
Uh-huh.
And so then all of that gets compiled into a report so that whatever agency kind of make informed decisions.
Cool.
But that information also gets sent to the New Mexico Cultural Resource Information System, which
okay.
is basically a centralized database for all of the sites in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, most archaeologists have access to that, and so they can use it for their research needs
cool.
as well. And so all that information, you know, it just essentially contributes to, like, this growing database of knowledge
uh-huh.
that we have that can be used to advance our understanding of the past in the region.
Uh-huh.
And then ideally that information can get disseminated to the public
mm-hmm.
or whatever, so that, you know, we can all learn.
This was archaeologist Cassandra Keys, more from Keys when we come back, as she shares with us her path to archaeology and her relationship with objects from the past. Welcome back to TCA Radio Hour. I'm Chelsea. Today, Cassandra Keys, an archaeologist in northern New Mexico, is in conversation with Elise Moyon. She shares insights about her relationship to the people that have been here before us and her work of investigation into the past.
So for me, it's like as you're wandering around, you're finding all these things that are as little as 50 years old, mm-hmm. and then up to 10,000 years old.
Yeah.
I haven't found anything too much older than that, but all these things also are found in like different settings and landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think for me is what prompted me to go back to school to get my master's in archaeology,
uh-huh.
is just kind of wanting to have a better understanding and know more about the artifacts that I was finding,
yeah.
and what they might say about how human behavior has changed and about cultures and how they change over time,
mm-hmm.
and specifically, you know, why certain technologies are used.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what really sealed the deal for me was when I realized I could get paid to, you know, wander around,
yeah.
and look for old stuff and then create stories based on the kinds of objects that we were finding.
Yeah, sounds like a good deal. Yeah. where did you go to school for your master's to study archaeology?
I went to UNM.
UNM in Albuquerque?
In Albuquerque, yeah.
And so was it a program specifically about New Mexico? Or is it just like archaeology that can apply to anywhere in the world? And then from there you learned about New Mexico or like those specific periods in North America?
The master's program is geared towards, I mean, it's a public archaeology degree, which...
Okay.
You know, public archaeology just is everything that's not academia.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's very much geared towards the Southwest,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, people can get jobs wherever. It's a great program because it kind of gets you in and out in a couple of years. But you get to learn all about the methods and the theories
mm-hmm.
of archaeology
mm-hmm.
and the history, and you can kind of tailor it to what you want to study.
Cool. And is that when you decided to focus on that specific period of time? I'm sorry, I forgot the name. 8,000 years ago?
The archaic period.
Archaic period, yeah.
No, I was, before then I was doing a project out on the Taos Plateau. And I guess when I first started doing work in the Southwest, it seems like everyone was studying Chaco.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's like when you think of New Mexico, definitely one of the things that you think about, I think, is probably Chaco Canyon
yeah.
or the Pueblos,
mm-hmm.
you know, pottery,
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. And then, of course, people... We're also studying the Paleo-Indian period,
mm-hmm.
which is like the Clovis and the Folsom times I was telling you about.
Uh-huh.
I think I was doing a project on the Taos Plateau, and I was just talking with my field supervisor and how the archaic period is like this understudied area in archaeology.
Okay.
For sure. And so I think the contrarian in me was just kind of like, I don't want to do what everyone else is doing, and so I'm going to, you know, this is so interesting that no one's really interested
in
this
yeah.
kind of stuff. And so for me, I mean, it's a fascinating period of time, too, because it encompasses most of human history in North America. Like, it's, you know, it goes from 8,000 years ago to 2,000 years ago.
Oh, wow.
So that's a long time.
That's a really long time.
That people were doing these things. And so the Paleo-Indian period is, you know, associated usually with, a subsistence economy that's focused on hunting.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when you see, like, you know, the mammoths and the bison and these
yeah.
sites. And actually the points, too, are... the projectile points that were made during that whole time, the Paleo-Indian period, are, like, just so beautiful, and they're so well made, and they're made from these just, like, exotic materials that are just colorful,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know, they're really beautiful. And then the archaic period kind of shifted, so it kind of represents this time when people shifted from not having, like, an economy focused on hunting, but more geared towards... exploiting like a variety of plant and animal resources.
I see.
And so it's the first time too in the archaeology record that you see groundstone, so like monos and metates,
uh-huh.
you know, which is kind of indicative of them processing more plant stuff.
Yeah.
Later in the archaic period, you know, you kind of start to see the adoption of agriculture.
Uh-huh.
People start incorporating maize into the diet. They start to become more sedentary
mm-hmm.
into, you know, these big population centers like Chaco Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And so the arcade parade itself is like is really broad. You know,
yeah.
There's a lot going on there I'm not really familiar with. But so the specific period of time within the arcade period that I look at is referred to as the early arcade period.
Okay.
And that's the time that's about 8,000 years ago to about 6,000 years ago. And what interests me about that is, like I was describing, those Paleo-Indian points and that, you know, subsistence economy that they had shifted, like, drastically. You started to see these, like, I mean, the points are made completely differently.
Uh-huh.
They're not really very nice, like, at all.
Uh-huh.
They're very crude.
Huh.
And they're made from different material.
Uh-huh.
Like, the, it seems like archaic people, you know, throughout the West and the Southwest especially, focused more on using, like, what you probably identify as, like, basalt.
Mm-hmm.
Like, volcanic
soil. Yeah.
So a lot
of
that more coarse-grained. It's, like, just black. It's, like, these local materials.
Uh-huh.
It's not all colorful and banded.
Interesting.
And so I'm really interested in why that shifted, like, why that changed.
Yeah.
And, you know, how that changed in technology, what that might say about changes in hunting strategy.
Uh-huh.
Or and cultural stuff, too. You know, like, you think about why, like, what cultural shift was there that people started to value this other resource. I wanted to feel like I was contributing something.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, if everyone's studying the Paleo-Indian period, it's just this, you know, really sexy time in archaeology. And then everyone else, you know, tends to focus on Chaco Canyon or later stuff that I just wanted to feel like if I was doing anything that it was going to actually be of value.
Yeah.
It might be important in some way. And, but no, there's no answers. I think one of the cop-out in archaeology is always just like, you know, we need more evidence to really come up with anything conclusive.
Fair enough.
During that time, too, like, the environment changed a lot. Like,
okay.
It became more similar to what we see now.
Okay.
And so people probably responded to that change in the environment by changing their hunting strategies and changing their subsistence. And so,
right.
You know, Paleo-Indian folks may have been focusing more on, like, hunting around playas or in open game settings. And so maybe it's the case that their projectile points are more conducive to hunting in that kind of environment. And then, you know, as the weather changed, those playas dried up, the environment changed, there's different resources become available, so people kind of have to adapt to that.
That makes sense, I guess. That's awesome, though. It's cool to be working on something that is not yet figured out. It's like, well, maybe we'll find out and we'll understand it.
Yeah, and I can't wait to see, you know, like, yeah, what people kind of come up with. And
yeah. Yeah, how connected is the world of archaeology? Like, are you reading articles about recent findings all the time, or
I should be. I try to keep up to date. So, you know, you can subscribe or become a member of various organizations. Like, the main one is the Society for American Archaeology, and they put out a quarterly journal. And luckily, I still have, you know, some friends at UNM.
Yeah.
Stay up to date with what they're doing.
Earlier, you talked about the story between the object. You know, like, you're like, there's a story to this object and I'm finding it. And now you're telling us about this specific period of time, like, that was between 8,000 years ago and 6,000 years ago. And I'm really curious about that story. Like, how do you relate to those objects and what that means?
People have been wandering around this area, you know, in our backyard, like, on the forest or on the plateau for thousands and thousands of years. And so it's fascinating for me, you know, to kind of think about how different I am from the people of the past and how disparate our cultures are. And so for me to think about, like, here's me and then here's this person from the past and, like, how we might have both felt the same way about this landscape.
Yeah.
You know, when you stop and you, like, find an artifact or something and you just kind of, like, look up at where you are.
Mm-hmm.
Like, especially, I'm thinking especially, like, on the plateau or something where there's not a whole lot of development, you know?
Yeah.
That, yeah, so it's just amazing to think that, you know, like, people across centuries and across cultures can kind of have the same ties to a place. And I think, you know, sometimes it's easy to just kind of pick up an object and think about it as just an object. And, you know, not think so much about the person made it. But one thing that I really like to kind of think about is, you know, we find, like, a broken projectile point. It's like, oh, was this person mad that this thing broke? Like, did they drop it when it broke? And, like, or were they, did they miss a shot? And you're pretty peeved, you know, at having missed their chance. Or, you know, when you find, like, some pot sherds, it's like, was this person, like, so sad when they dropped, like, their water pot and it shattered into, you know, hundreds of pieces. And so for me, sometimes just, like, thinking about the human emotions that may be connected to those artifacts, Gives me goosebumps. It's probably not all that different, like, you know, if you lose something or you break something.
Right.
Just going to be just 30 people, you know?
Yeah. But the fact that there were people 1,000 years ago is just insane. That, you know, people that were feeling the same emotions as we do today is...
I know, it's absolutely...
Mind-blowing.
Something I really like to think about. And then also just, I mean, making that connection, I think that one thing is really interesting, and again, it's a hard feeling to describe, but sometimes you can find pottery that has fingerprints in it.
Oh.
Or, you know, when you see, like, mm-hmm. the plaster on, like, adobe structures... that have, like, handprints in them from people, like, making their houses. And so just to kind of connect with that and say, like, oh, like, I know how that feels to, like, make something. And but just to associate it with a person. Because it's easy to define, like, an arrowhead, like, it's a rock.
Yeah.
You know, that someone made. But
yeah,
actually like have the evidence of, like, a physical human.
Yeah, it's a whole different sense of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that when I'm doing archaeology, sometimes for me, like, you know, it isn't just about this, like, connection with the past,
mm-hmm.
but also what, like, future archaeologists mm-hmm. might say about, like, if, you know, what they would say about me if they just found, like, an object that belonged to me,
yeah.
or what they might say about my family life if they were to excavate my house. you know, and so when I think about things, I do think a lot about how archaeology would interpret this time that we're living in. There's a really funny book. I should have brought it to show you, but it's called, I think it's called Hotel of the Mysteries.
Uh-huh.
Something like that. But it's kind of about, like, the demise of American civilization and how a future archaeologist comes in and tries to interpret
uh-huh.
what he's finding. And so what happens is America basically gets buried in plastic and, like, all this refuse.
Uh-huh.
And he's wandering around trying to, you know, find signs of ancient life. And but one thing that he can see is, like, the... essentially like a strip where there's just like fast food chains.
Oh my God.
You know, so he interprets that as being like this ritual and like a significant road that people would walk to like homage to the gods.
I think you're a board member, maybe even the president or the vice president.
Vice president.
Okay. Of the Taos Archaeological... Oh, it's hard. Archaeological Society. Yeah.
You say TAS.
TAS, right. Can you tell us about it?
TAS, as far as I understand, has been around, you know, kind of for a long time. They've been around since the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And the purpose of the society is to assist in the conservation and preservation of cultural and historical sites in New Mexico, you know, and to promote public awareness, I think, of the cultural heritage of the Taos area specifically. And they do that by means of, like, or, you know, through programs that involve the public,
mm-hmm.
like in field trips and lectures and fieldwork projects. And I myself am pretty new to the Taos Archaeological Society, so I can't tell you too much about things that have gone on in the past.
Right.
And right now, you know, we're not really up to too much just
Yeah.
So we're trying to just get organized and plan things for next year.
I see. But does that mean that if you become a member of TAS, you could go out on field trips and to excavation sites or dig sites? And
recently, in the past, I guess, just a few years ago, they've done excavations. They did an excavation in partnership with the Forest Service at a small rock shelter site in the Valle Vidal.
Wow.
And I think they do some things down at Pot Creek Pueblo,
mm-hmm.
especially, you know, TAS kind of is involved also with UNM.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of go out there and people can do stuff. There's a ceramics group that is, you know, analyzing some ceramics from some excavations at Picarese Pueblo.
Oh, cool.
I believe. But yeah, absolutely. If you are a member, you are welcome to participate on field trips and on fieldwork projects that we have planned. If you want to stay in the loop or, you know, be involved in any of these projects.
Yeah.
Or just want to learn more about regional or local archaeology,
mm-hmm.
I encourage everyone to go to taosarch.org, which is TAOSARCH.org, and become a member.
Oh, cool.
And you can kind of do some of those things. And there's also in there a link to the SiteWatch program,
uh-huh.
Which is... I think it's under partner organizations, I think, on the website.
Okay.
But SiteWatch is, you know, a great opportunity for citizen volunteers to assist land management agencies.
Okay.
Like Forest Service or the BLM. And they're preservation partners in protecting some of New Mexico's cultural resources.
What do you do when you are part of SiteWatch?
So SiteWatch, they have sites that are designated, you know, by the state. Mm-hmm. It's a statewide thing. And volunteers just kind of go out, I mean, as often as they want, but at least a few times a year, and mm-hmm. just kind of check on the condition of the site, see if there's been any damage or trash or looting.
I see.
So a lot of them are rock art sites.
Okay.
And so you just kind of want to go and maybe make a presence and just educate people if they're around.
Yeah.
Or just monitor the site, and then you kind of just come up with a little report that gets turned in.
Cool.
To that agency.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's lots of opportunities to participate in things.
That was Cassandra Keys, an archaeologist who works here in northern New Mexico. If you want to learn more about the Taos Archaeological Society, you can visit their website at taosarch.org. That's TAOSARCH.org. TCA RadioR is supported by this station, KNCE 93.5 FM, streaming at truetaosradio.com, and our local business partner, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services. We'll be here next Monday at 9 a.m. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.